Good morning. I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals. Thank you for being here today. I understand that everyone is ready. Before we begin, I do want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Mike Wallach, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief of the Court. Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call
Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Andrew Gould for the appellant, June Fisher. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. In granting summary judgment for BNSF, the trial court fundamentally erred by treating the 2006 release as if it were governed by ordinary common law principles. Under the unique statutory context of the Federal Employers Liability Act, the court could not simply apply a common law four corners of the contract approach. Rather, under Section 5, it was required to carefully scrutinize the release. And as courts nationwide understand, that careful scrutiny usually takes one of two approaches. The Sixth Circuit's bright line known injuries test from Babbitt, or the Third Circuit's fact-intensive known risks approach from Wicker. This court should join its federal and state counterparts in adopting either of these approaches. And regardless of which approach it chooses, summary judgment was improper. This court should reverse.
So how is this different from Collier, which is also a Third Circuit case?
The Collier case?
Yes.
So this case is different from in Collier is an application of Wicker. I mean, that's a fundamental point. And so at least there, the court applied Wicker. Now, it went into the record and searched, it looked at the release as one part of the evidence. But here, by contrast, the court conducted no factual inquiry aside from looking at the release.
And what factual inquiry was there available based upon your response in the trial court?
Based upon our response in the trial court, it was not our burden to point to evidence, to show evidence that he indeed did not know the risks. I mean, this, after all, BNSF had the burden. It was relying on affirmative the release as an affirmative defense. It had the burden on summary judgment.
At least not entitled to facial validity?
Not under Wicker, Your Honor. Under Wicker, Wicker's very explicit on this. It says that we are wary, and that's the court's words, we are wary of giving
Collier, the court there looked at that and looked at the face of the release as well, too, didn't they?
Yes, Your Honor. They did in Collier.
So what was the factual basis in Collier that was put up to oppose the release, or was there any?
I'd have to look at the case, and I can when I sit down to and be more prepared for rebuttal. But what I would say is that, in at least in all of these cases, well, even in Collier, they're applying Wicker. They're applying one of the two tests. And here, by contrast, the trial court just conducted an ordinary common law analysis.
To Mendoza,
sure.
Which the trial court looked just at the face of the release, which the Fifth Circuit just affirmed.
Correct.
So both those courts are getting to the same point as Collier, just without using the same language, correct?
Yes, but I think it's extremely important for this court to at least adopt the correct approach. And, you know, we brought Mendoza-Gomez to this court in reply because it's important for this court to see, hear all the courts in terms of how they're handling this. Respectfully, Mendoza-Gomez, the Fifth Circuit's opinion, is unpersuasive. It applies just the same, an ordinary common law approach, even as BNSF's oral argument handout, which it filed yesterday, recognizes they don't adopt either approach. They don't even analyze other approaches. I don't usually block quote opinions in my briefs, and I did so intentionally in our reply brief because it's important for this court to see here is the sum total of the analysis. And the sum total of the analysis, I believe, is three sentences with parentheticals. It's one paragraph. And it all rests on Cowan, right? I mean, that's what the Fifth Circuit says. And the Fifth Circuit says that Cowan rejected this, quote, precise argument. Respectfully, that's not correct. As federal and state courts nationwide understand, and you can see this at reply page 10 and footnote 3, federal and state courts nationwide understand Cowan doesn't resolve this issue of how to approach a release for a future injury.
What about Jarrett from Pennsylvania?
I'm sorry?
The Jarrett case from Pennsylvania, once again, they decided that from the face of the release without any looking beyond the face of the release because it wasn't presented in a response to the motion for summary judgment, correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, but again, I would just get back to even in these cases, I think the fundamental point, the first main point I would say is that this court needs to adopt either Babbitt or Wicker. It should not simply do what the trial court did here and apply a common law four corners of the contract approach.
But what I'm trying to get at is, though, under if you adopt Wicker, then even under Collier or Jarrett, you still get to the same place by looking at the face of the release, and so unless somebody else brings a response, which creates a factual issue as to the intent of the parties, correct?
Well, no. I mean, respectfully, no, Your Honor. Under Wicker, at least, first off, I guess 2 points. First off, if you – a faithful application of Wicker at least requires some attempt to examine the factual circumstances. And so I would refer this court to the Murphy opinion from the Arkansas Court of Appeals, where there that the Murphy court applies Wicker, says that we agree that the Wicker approach is the proper approach, but the trial court did not apply that here. And so we're going to remand in the first instance for the trial court to do that. That's one avenue that this court could do if it were to adopt the Wicker approach. But again, I get back to the main point. I'm sorry for being a broken record on this, but it's just very important to us that neither of these approaches were adopted. And the same is true in Mendoza-Gomez. And Mendoza-Gomez, again, from the Fifth Circuit, it's an unpublished case. It's not binding on that court. And respectfully, even if I were sitting here and standing in front of the Fifth Circuit, I would say the same things as to why it's unpersuasive. It doesn't deal with the text and the purpose of Section 5, which all these state and federal courts, at least nationwide, are grappling with. They understand that FELA is a unique statute. That's the key here. FELA, the purpose of FELA congressional purpose is to provide liberal recovery for injured rail workers. Section 5 of FELA is a broad prohibition on the exemption of liability. In McBride, which is the U.S. Supreme Court's most recent case, I believe, from 2011, on FELA, even all nine justices, both the five in the majority and the four in dissent, recognize that Section 5 is one of the main departures from common law, which is that in terms of its exemption of liability. What Cowan says is that parties can compromise for a claimed liability, which in that case is a past single injury. That's not the case here. And that's why this issue is open. It's dividing courts nationwide. But at least, again, if you think about it now, between the federal circuits, there's now three approaches, right? On the one hand, there's the Babbitt-Bright line test, which we've advocated for this court to adopt. There's the Wicker test, which is a fact-intensive approach. And then finally, there's Mendoza-Gomez to the extent, even let's assume that it was published, that just applies a common law approach. Now, again, we've explained why we think Babbitt provides the better of the rules, but at least both Babbitt and Wicker make an effort to deal with the text and purpose of Section 5 and treating it as different. And so, I'm sorry, Justice Walk.
Do you agree with the Arkansas court, which says that the majority courts have adopted Wicker?
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt about that, that the majority of the courts have adopted Wicker, of course. You know, in terms of if you were joining a circuit split, if you will, you're not necessarily bound by who has the most votes. It's which is the the most correct approach. And if I may, let me explain why we think that Babbitt is the superior approach. And there are three reasons. The first is it harmonizes Cowan with the plain text of Section 5. And I've discussed why that Section 5 is a departure from common law. The second sentence of Cowan, which is the payment offset proviso, discusses, quote, on account of the injury or death for which said action was brought. That's, in effect, referring to a past single injury. And then beyond the text, employers from undermining the liability scheme to provide liberal recovery for injured workers. And I want to go back, actually, to one of the earliest FELA cases, which is Duncan, which precedes Cowan, where the U.S. Supreme Court said Congress wanted Section 5 to have the full effect that its comprehensive phraseology implies. Part of that comprehensive phraseology is recognizing that Cowan only deals with a single past injury. And finally, the bright line test will lead to predictable and uniform results across the board. And so we think that, that Babbitt states the better of the two rules. But again, I'm not here saying that, you know, there aren't arguments in favor of Wicker, or, for example, that the majority of the courts follow Wicker. They do. But what I am saying, again, is that those courts nationwide that engage in a contextualized, detailed analysis of Cowan and Section 5 pick one of those two approaches. And I guess just to, you know, return, Justice Walk, to some of your earlier questions about the language of the release, I would simply say that to the extent other courts are relying simply on the face of the release itself, then that runs afoul of Wicker.
Why is it not consistent with Wicker to say that from a procedural standpoint, if the plaintiff thinks that there is an issue with respect to the intent of the parties, which is the governing factor under either Wicker or under Wicker, that if they don't come forward with a response which creates a fact issue, then you look to the face of the release?
I suppose that would be, Your Honor, an extension in a sense of Wicker. Again, we go back to the point of it's BNSF's burden as the party that's relying on the affirmative release. And here we are looking at a summary judgment record that is silent as to what risks, if we're applying Wicker, as to what risks the parties thought about at the time of the 2006 release. And so based on that record, there are genuine issues as to what the parties intended at the time. Again, it may be that it goes back, if this court were to reverse and, let's say, find a fact issue on this and we go to trial, it's not as if you can't rely on the release as evidence. No doubt they can, but it's just one piece of evidence. And again, we would go back to it, this was BNSF's burden to present certain evidence of that.
Section 5 clearly prohibits contracting around FELA, correct?
Correct.
So there's a distinction between a prophylactic release, arguably, and an effective release, if you will, dealing. And that's what you're arguing, and that's what you're saying Babbitt says, is basically Babbitt says you cannot contract around only potential, unaccrued claim.
That's correct.
Okay. And no, I don't think anybody cited it, but there's a Texas Supreme Court case, non-FELA, called Puszczewski, which deals specifically with the statute of limitations and accrual, and says that asbestosis, the mere fact that you've accrued and you've developed asbestosis, doesn't actually form the basis for an accrual of the meso claim, and therefore they're distinct injuries legal injuries for purposes of limitations. Is that what Babbitt, and Puszczewski's been cited by the United States Supreme Court with regard to the fear of cancer cases and that type of thing. So is that essentially what you're arguing Babbitt does, is it specifically says that a railroad cannot simply because there is an immediate cause of action, extend that immediacy of that cause of action to then contract around a potential cause of action that may never actually ever accrue.
That's correct, Justice Birdwell. I would say that in terms of the accrual, you know, I think this has come up in the, you know, the separate disease rule that you see in the U.S. Supreme Court, such as in the Ayers case. And we haven't relied on the Ayers case before this court for the proposition of Ayers and its treatment of accrual and statute of limitations is what drives Babbitt. But what we have said is that Babbitt dealt just by its plain text with just a single past injury, and for the reasons that you've stated, as well as the general purpose of FELA, as well as the text, the second sentence that I previously quoted, it can't be more than the single injury. At that case, it might have been asbestos exposure, or at most asbestosis, but not lung cancer. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Sanders?
Thank you. May it please the court. It's been the law for 70 years that settling disputed FELA controversies is simply different than prospectively avoiding FELA liability, which is the distinction Justice Birdwell pointed out and picked up on. And there's no problem under Section 5 with settling a disputed FELA liability. That's what the Supreme Court told us in the late 1940s in Callan. A release settling a disputed FELA claim is not a device to exempt from liability within Section 5's meaning. It stands apart from that. Just last month, the Fifth Circuit in the Mendoza-Gomez case that you referenced joined the majority of courts recognizing that there is no problem when you have a prior release for some sort of toxic exposure that recognizes the risk and explicitly disclaims cancer, and then later you bring a cancer suit, that release can apply to bar that. That's no problem. And it's the distinction between a disputed liability claim and these broad general releases that drives the analysis in this case. The trial court got it right by properly applying it to Mr. Fisher's unambiguous release. And I heard Mr. Gould say several times, you know, the trial court didn't do an analysis. It didn't do a thorough analysis. That's not at all clear. We don't have the reporter's record here, and it doesn't really matter because in a summary judgment proceeding, the trial court's not supposed to make factual findings. So what the trial court did or didn't do, there's not anything in the record to reflect that. So we disagree with that characterization.
Was at the time of the signing of this release, was there an actual diagnosed asbestos-related disease for which the decedent was being treated?
Our position is there was. It's not clear from the record, but I don't think it ultimately matters. They said...
The reason I ask that is because Puszczewski also talks about the fact that mere parenchymal and or pleural changes that are attributed to the inhalation of asbestos doesn't get you there in terms of accrual.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm not sure where that would leave us with regard to this. All it does for me is make it very clear that asbestos-related disease is treated very differently with regard to how it can be prosecuted one way or the other.
I think for accrual, that's right. And I think in this case, the record's not totally clear, but we know they told the trial court in their summary judgment response he had a cognizable claim for asbestosis. He released asbestosis in the 2006 release. So
let's say he wasn't. He didn't actually have a diagnosis of asbestosis. Let's say he didn't even have any. All he had was asbestos exposure. Okay, no actual injury. There's a threat of a possible litigation in the future, but he's retiring. So to wrap everything up in a nice bow, the railroad decides, let's go ahead and release this. Would you not agree that that's exactly what Section 5 is intended to prohibit, is just kind of a prophylactic, we'll say it's a release, but it's really prophylactically contracting around potential liability in the future?
I think it would depend on the way that it came up and what the release actually said. I think if it just said, you're retiring from the railroad, you can't have any more claims for anything whatsoever.
Including for cancer or anything.
Broadly, hey, you worked at the railroad, take this money, sign this release that says you can never sue us for anything having to do with working at the railroad.
We knew you were exposed at some point in time to asbestos. Here's a nice little going away present, but we need you to sign off on this release with regard to that. I think clearly Section 5 would be contracting around FELA liability.
I think if it's in the context of no FELA dispute being brought up and the railroad just comes and says, hey, you know, nice knowing you signed this, I think you're probably right. I think that that's the Babbitt situation, but that's not what we had here.
How do we know that?
How do we know what? I'm sorry.
How do we know that's not what happened here?
Because he hired an attorney, brought a claim to BNSF in 2005 for asbestos exposure, and then they negotiated that release.
So there's a release, but where does it say that he brought a claim which was released? It is a release of a claim, correct?
It is a release of a claim, correct.
Does it say, I mean, some releases, whereas this person has made a claim, whereas this person has denied it, whereas we've engaged in discovery, whereas we want to settle that, there's no whereases in this release, right?
There's no whereases? No, there's no whereases in
here.
So
how do we know from this record that he brought a claim which has been negotiated, which is being released, as opposed to what Justice Birdwell hypothecated?
Well, because he hired an attorney and brought the claim. I don't believe that's a disputed fact in the record, and I can double-check and provide, you know, supplemental briefing if the court wants it. I don't have it.
Does it matter whether an actual lawsuit's been filed or just, hey,
I'm going with the hypotheticals.
Sure.
Yes, he has an attorney, but we don't know whether the railroad approached him or he approached the railroad with a claim.
I don't believe it's disputed that he approached the railroad. I can double-check and file some supplemental briefing. I don't know the answer standing here, but I don't believe that that's a disputed fact here. But, I mean, to your point, I think when the employee says, I know enough to know that I've been exposed, I know enough to know that I'm hiring an attorney, and there's a dispute here as to whether or not the railroad provided me a reasonably safe workplace, we're getting out of the Section 5 concerns that we were talking about. You're getting into a disputed claimed liability, and that's the point where it kicks out of Section 5 under Callan, and the parties can begin to negotiate and settle their release without having any Section 5 problems. And that's what Callan says. It is from the text, I think, that these rulings come, and Callan talks about exempting from liability. By definition, if someone is saying, hey, I was exposed to asbestos, I've got an attorney, I recognize that there's some sort of issue with my rights here and I'm potentially injured, let's talk about this and work this out, and the railroad says, sure, at that point you do have a claimed liability. We're not trying to exempt ourselves from liability. We certainly may disagree factually whether or not we provided them a reasonably safe workplace, but we're not trying to say, oh, well, we don't have any further FELA duties to you, or, oh, we don't owe you anything. It's just, we disagree that you didn't have a reasonably safe workplace, or we disagree with the extent of your injuries, whatever that is, but certainly parties are allowed to compromise that. Callan says that exactly. It says that the parties are free.
You would agree that the mere fact that somebody develops asbestosis doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to develop meso.
Sure. No question about that.
The Supreme Court of Texas and Poschewski says there's like a 15% chance that if you develop asbestosis, you are going to develop meso.
Sure.
That's one of the reasons why they make meso a distinct injury for purposes of accrual basis, because if they say it's all a one injury in a single action, then literally you're going to have to file suit for a cause of action, i.e. the diagnosis of meso, that you can't prove because you haven't essentially accrued that cause of action yet.
Absolutely. And
why do we not apply that reasoning here, that what you were dealing with regard to this particular release was immediate asbestosis anticipation, but there's nothing in this record to indicate that, in fact, just because there was exposure to asbestosis, that he would, in fact, develop cancer. So the inclusion of cancer language in the release was a prophylactic contracting around FELA liability in the future.
Because he was certainly entitled to acknowledge and understand that his allegations that he had been exposed to asbestos are linked to potential cancer in the future. He was absolutely entitled to understand that and recognize it. He did recognize it. He recognized it explicitly multiple times in the release. And there's nothing in the text of the FELA, Section 5. There's nothing in Callan that suggests that there's any sort of problem with that. Certainly.
Can we, under either Babbitt or Wicker or any other authority, take a look at how much the actual release was for, the consideration to make a determination of what the intent was, that $29,000 would be sufficient with regard to an actual meso diagnosis, which is going to eventually result in death?
No, I think the answer is no, you don't really need to when they haven't put on any sort of evidence to create a fact issue there. Mendoza-Gomez says that exactly. In Mendoza-Gomez, they didn't even have the settlement amount. It was redacted out, and the court said it doesn't really matter. And the Maynard case from the United States Supreme Court says the standard in an FELA is they get some sort of compensation that they wouldn't otherwise be entitled to. That's the consideration. And there's no question he got that here. There's no dispute about that. And there was no dispute in the trial court. They didn't put on any fact issues that, well, you know, in other cases, this is what the settlement was. Or the attorney didn't put on an affidavit, as they have in some other cases, saying, oh, well, we wouldn't have taken this amount had we known that this was for these things. There's none of that. And the release is unambiguous, and it ties the consideration here, the $29,500. It's in the exact same paragraph where it says, I'm giving up all suits and actions whatsoever asbestos-related illnesses, including but not limited to cancer, risk of cancer, and fear of cancer. This is not one of the long kind of boilerplate type releases that Wicker was talking about. You know, in Wicker, you had some sort of unrelated injury and a very broad, to your point, prophylactic waiver that says, hey, can't sue us anymore. We've settled this out. Whatever comes up now, not our problem anymore. And Wicker said, no, that doesn't work. That's boilerplate. You can't just list every possible hazard that you could ever encounter on the railroad and say, well, you settled this particular claim, so you can't come back ever again. That's not what this case is. To your point in Collier, this case is right down the middle. He understood he was exposed to asbestos, hired an attorney, brought a claim, settled that, recognizing explicitly cancer, risk of cancer, and fear of cancer. It didn't list every possible hazard. It didn't list every possible exposure. It was very, very specific and very narrowly tied those cancer risks to asbestos-related illnesses. So we know there's a connection there. And the fact that he was represented by an attorney and then says later on the next page, my attorney's explained this to me. I've relied on his advice. I haven't relied on anything BNSF has said. And then separately says, and by the way, I read this and I fully understand it, and this is my intent to do so. In those types of cases, we're back to Mendoza-Gomez. We're back to Collier, where you don't have to go beyond the face of the release. There's nothing in the record to create a fact issue here. And perhaps there's an appropriate case where you could do that on consideration. The Murphy case had, that both of you had mentioned, had an affidavit from the wife, had an affidavit from the attorney, and they said, you know, we did not have any understanding at the time that this is what we were doing. That was never brought up to us. These risks weren't something that we understood. And the court said appropriately, well, then there's a fact issue there. That's not this case. This case, you have a very clear, explicit release, covers exactly what we're talking about here from the same exposures. And I think it's important to note here, this really is a single exposure over the course of his career case. He settled that, and the timing does matter a little bit because he brought the claim and then retired before he signed the release and settled it. So there's no new exposures here. This isn't the kind of case where he later came back to the railroad and said, well, you know, I got exposed to something else, so maybe, you know, this is a different exposure, different injury. All of the exposures allegedly had occurred by the time he signed this release, and there's nothing new. So he certainly was entitled to sit down with his attorney when he did that, look through this and say, okay, I recognize here's the things that could happen, and I just want this to be over with. I want to be done. And he's allowed to do that. There's nothing in the text of Section 5 that prevents him from being able to do so. One of the things that I heard in opening was the burden of proof, the burden of proof. The reality is we did what we need to do. Mendoza-Gomez, Collier says that. We put the release in. The release is very explicit. It's very careful in the way that it ties these things together and ties cancer to asbestos exposure without this broad sort of boilerplate that you find in some of these other cases that has been problematic. And that matters because we don't have to go beyond the release. Under Callan, it was then incumbent on them to put something in that creates a fact issue as to intent. And that's not there. And, you know, there are cases where courts have gone beyond where, for example, the release is so silent, it doesn't mention cancer, it doesn't mention any sort of hazards, and it just sort of generally releases it. And courts have said, well, in that case, it's not clear what the intent was. And, you know, the opposite of that is Wicker. Well, it says anything that you could ever run into on the railroad is now out because you had a prior back injury. And Wicker says, well, that also is not okay. That's too broad. And so in that case, you can't look at the intent. This case is neither of those. It's right in the middle, and it's exactly what Mendoza-Gomez recognized, that all you really have to do is look at the release. Does it say exactly what's at issue here? Yes. Is it tied to the same underlying alleged exposures? Yes. Did he get consideration for that? Yes. Was he represented by an attorney? Yes. He said he was represented by an attorney. He said he relied upon his attorney's advice. His attorney actually signed the release as approved. All of these things put together meet our burden to prove as a matter of law that the release is valid. And there's nothing in Section 5 that specifically does that. And, you know, one of the things that they also say is, well, Callan was a single past injury. But that's not what Callan says. In Callan, the release was for a prior accident and a back injury. But what the release said was, I release all claims which I have or can or may have. And the Supreme Court didn't find a Section 5 problem there. Certainly it remanded because there were some issues with the instructions, and it was something that the railroad was entitled to argue on remand. But the idea that Callan was just this isolated past injury only, that's not what the release actually said in that case, and I think that that's important. We've talked about the separate disease rule, but there are cases like Collier and Cole that say whether or not a case is accrued for purposes of bringing a lawsuit is a different analysis than whether someone who's settling a claim can understand, well, these are all potential things that could happen here, recognize that, and negotiate those risks. I mean, to your point, he may not have known for sure that he was going to get cancer, but he certainly was entitled to take that risk into account in determining the terms that he's willing to settle for. And in contrast, the railroad was certainly allowed to look at that potential risk of liability that they might have, and they're entitled to look at that in coming together and reach a settlement that everybody agrees to. And that's what happened here based on the release. There's no issue that there's fraud. There's no issue that there's mutual mistake. There's no issue that BNSF ever breached the release up to the point that they filed this lawsuit. So none of the classic contract defenses are there. The whole argument that they've made really turns on Section 5 here. And that's why Mendoza-Gomez and Collier are the right fit for this case, because you really don't have to look beyond the sides of the release to figure that. Now, just briefly, I don't want to spend too much time on this because they've told you you have to make a choice. This court doesn't have to make a choice. This court is not bound by the Third Circuit. It's not bound by the Sixth Circuit. It's not bound by the Fifth Circuit. We think the Fifth Circuit presents the proper analytical approach because under the statute, you really don't have to go beyond what they've said here. But they've given several reasons why they think that Babbitt is a better fit. We disagree, and one of the reasons that I think there's a problem with Babbitt is, despite what they say, Babbitt really is less protective of worker rights, because there's no question, and Callan told us this more than 70 years ago, workers absolutely have the right to settle their FELA claims. But Callan says, well, we're going to limit that right. Wicker doesn't do that. Mendoza-Gomez doesn't do that. The cases applying the Wicker line of cases don't do that, and that is an important thing, because not every doubt in the FELA gets resolved in favor of the employee. And we know that because the Supreme Court said it in the case called Norfolk Railway versus Sorrell in 2007. It said, this remedial purpose does not require us to interpret every uncertainty in the act in favor of employees. Long before that, in 1953, in the Buffalo Railway case versus Ahern, the Supreme Court said again, untainted by fraud or overreaching, full and fair compromises of FELA claims do not clash with the policy of the Act. So this long discussion about FELA policy fails to recognize that it's within the policy for these parties to be able to come to terms to settle these differences without going to court. Where you start to run into problems is where you have releases that either have nothing to do with an FELA dispute, the prophylactic release that you talked about, or releases that go beyond the confines of what the parties actually brought up. Here, that's not what we have. Asbestos exposure claim, asbestos exposure settlement, talking specifically about cancer, narrowly about cancer tied to asbestos exposure. And here, on the face of their petition, they say this is occupational asbestos-related lung cancer. So there's no question of a disconnection between the suit that we're talking about here today in this case and the claims that were brought and settled later. I see that my time's running short. Unless the court has anything, I would just end with asking the court to join the majority of courts, now including the Fifth Circuit, that hold that a prior toxic exposure release of FELA claims that covers cancer precludes later suits for those exposures. And under all those cases, this court should affirm the trial court's judgment. That's the Fifth Circuit, the Third Circuit, the Mississippi courts, the Virginia courts, the New York courts, the Michigan courts, the West Virginia courts, the Pennsylvania courts. This court should join those. Thank you.
A few points on rebuttals, Your Honor, and I want to begin with where my friend ended, which by saying that this court should join the majority of courts. So let's be clear. What is the majority of courts? The majority of courts is Wicker. It's not Mendoza-Gomez. And I heard during my friend's argument that he kept saying Mendoza-Gomez and Collier and joining them together. They're different cases. They apply different analytical approaches. Collier applies Wicker. Mendoza-Gomez simply applies a common law four corners of the contract approach. Justice Wallach, you had asked me during my opening argument about the distinctions between Collier in this case, and I apologize for not having an answer at that time. What I would say in looking back at the case there, there was an undisputed record and a district court factual finding regarding what the parties knew at this time. And again, we don't have that record here. If this court is going to join the, quote, majority, then it would need to join, then it would follow, I suppose, the Third Circuit and Wicker. But aside from the Fifth Circuit's unpublished opinion in Mendoza-Gomez, courts are not applying this common law analysis. In Callan, for example, Callan's important to understand what that was for. My friend is right. It was for a back injury, and when he went back and sued, it was because his back injury had gotten worse. It was for the same injury. We are talking about different injuries here. Asbestosis is a non-malignant disease. Lung cancer is a malignant disease, and FILA is different. Callan does not settle this. If Callan clearly settled this, you wouldn't have all these courts grappling with this issue and actually explicitly saying that Callan does not resolve this issue. And so he's right that this court is not bound by the Third Circuit, it's not bound by the Sixth Circuit, and it's not bound by the Fifth Circuit. But again, to kind of return to the spectrum I did earlier, at least Wicker and Babbitt are more faithful to the text and the purpose of Section 5.
Let me ask a couple of questions. One, when you said that your client had a cognizable claim, exactly what were you referencing there? What did you mean by the term cognizable claim?
I'm sorry, are you referring to our briefing or the briefing before this court or below?
Where you made the statement that your client had a cognizable claim.
Right. It was a cognizable claim for asbestos exposure. And that's all it was. I mean, that's all it was at the time.
It was a claim.
Yes.
And it was a cognizable claim.
Yes.
Okay. The second thing is, if you have in situations where you have a claim which is made, a release of that claim, okay, and that the releases not only existing claims, but future claims that are tied to that first claim, okay. For example, asbestosis, and then the future claim of potential cancer, okay? As opposed to a situation where you have a shoulder injury, which says future injuries, and then says cancer, okay? There's a disconnect there. So in cases where you don't have that disconnect, you have asbestosis, cancer caused by asbestos, why shouldn't we, since we're not bound by any of these authorities that are out there so far, say that in cases where there is a release which has that follow-through of asbestos, asbestosis, asbestos-related cancer, that if there's an issue as to the intent of the parties, that shouldn't be the burden of the plaintiff to raise, since there is a clear follow-through from beginning to end on the injury, release, and future.
I see my red light is on, but if I may answer the question. So I think it depends on which approach the court adopts, right? I mean, so if you agree with us in terms of Babbitt, then it doesn't matter whether there's follow-through. If you apply Wicker, then that the releases language might be relevant to determining whether it was a known risk, but you can't simply rely on the language of the release itself. And as to your point about the burden of proof, we would simply just get back to, we're not here claiming mutual mistake or fraud, unlike Mendoza-Gomez, which did. We are here saying that the burden was on BNSF to show that the parties contemplated the risks, and BNSF failed to meet that burden.
Along that lines, could have carved out and reserved a right with regard to the development of cancer with regard to this release, correct?
Correct. But if I may, and I don't mean to, if the court will indulge me very briefly, that gets back to the language of the release. And my friend described it as not boilerplate, and I would say it is boilerplate. I mean, it releases claims and demands of every character whatsoever, asbestos-related illnesses, including but not limited to cancer, risk of cancer, and fear of cancer. It applies to every single disease that is possibly related to asbestos. The only thing that's unique about this release is the person's name and the consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been very helpful. Your case has now been submitted. We'll take a recess.
All right.